Welcome back, podcast listeners. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida, and this is Questioning Medicine 2018. I am coming up on the end of this little trial of trying to release a new podcast every 7 to 10 days. But I want to hear your feedback. Do you like it? Do you not like it? Do you wish to do something different? Do you wish I'd just shut up? All of them are viable answers, viable solutions, but I want to hear from you. I want to know, what do you think? What do you want to hear more of? What do you like? Because really, we're doing this for you, doing it to make it easier for you to learn, easier for you to bring better knowledge, better patient care to your patients. So let me know. Tweet me at AndrewBilt or email me at AndrewBilt@gmail.com or at QuestioningMedicine@gmail.com. All of them are reasonable. I will respond to all of them in a timely manner as soon as I get to them, but I want to hear from you. I want to know what you think. So get back to me. Let me know. Without any further hesitation and without any further reservation, here we go. Let's kick it off. Question Medicine 2018. All right, so many articles, so little time, so let's get right to it. The first article I want to talk about is has to do with the prevalence of pulmonary embolism in patients with syncope. That's not only what the article talks about, but that's actually the title of the article as well. This came in JAMA Internal Medicine back in January, and this paper looked at basically what's the prevalence of pulmonary embolism in patients with syncope. The patient presents with syncope, what's the odds that it's a pulmonary embolism? Some of you might remember or recall there was a big fuss or uproar back in October of 2016 when the New England Journal of Medicine released an article titled Prevalence of Pulmonary Embolism Among Patients Hospitalized for Syncope. It was, needless to say, quite controversial because they found that 17% of patients that presented with syncope had a pulmonary embolism, and that put everyone in an uproar because that means that one out of six patients that comes in with syncope had a pulmonary embolism. I mean, at that rate, at such a high rate, we have to ask ourselves, should we be scanning everyone? And let's be honest, the workup for a pulmonary embolism is not without its faults. I mean, you have D-dimers, you have the radiation, you have the contrast, the allergy to contrast. Maybe not necessarily acute kidney injury, as we're seeing that may not be actually a thing now with the new contrast that we use. However, you still have the radiation, you have the time, the effort, the money. If you're using the CAT scan to work up somebody for a pulmonary embolism, then you're not using the CAT scan for someone else. If your radiologist is reading a normal CAT scan study over and over and over again, then he's not reading or she's not reading other tests that would be more beneficial or maybe the more acutely ill patients. So it's really just a lot of resources. But if we need to do it, we need to do it. And that's what this looked at. This paper looked at what is the prevalence of pulmonary embolism. Now, this is a retrospective cohort study, but basically they found that if you took all comers that presented to the emergency department with syncope, all comers, everyone, you're looking at about 0.06 to 0.55%. So half a percent of the patients had a pulmonary embolism. And if you just looked at those that came in with syncope and then ended up getting admitted to the hospital, again, we're looking at 0.15 to 2%. That's a little higher, but again, those patients are a little sicker. If you come in with syncope and you need to be admitted to the hospital, you're a sicker patient. So I would expect the numbers there to be a little higher. This is interesting, but what I think this really tells us is that these probably are the numbers that we're all seeing. I mean, when this paper came out in New England Journal of Medicine 2016 that said 17% or one in six patients roughly are being found to have a pulmonary embolism when they come in or present with syncope, I think that threw everyone into an uproar because they said, I'm not finding that in the real world. But am I not finding it because I'm not looking for it? Or am I not finding it because I'm not finding it? And I think that this is what it should be. The test is a good test. And there are people that will need a CAT scan, they'll need the pulmonary embolism workup, but not every patient needs it. And just like any test out there, just like any drug out there, I think that it should go back to do the test if the clinical index or your clinical suspicion indicates that it's necessary. Now on to my favorite medical joke. And that, of course, is the joke where you say, hey, I'm going to go urinate. Although, I'm sure most people think that you're a 10. Ba-dum-bum. What you don't get there is that urinate, you know, like, anyways, if I have to explain it, you just don't get the joke. But it's a really funny joke if you get it. So, that brings me to the next article. The next article, of course, is about urination, the bodily function, the bodily fluid, and not necessarily urination in itself, but a urinary tract infection. The paper was titled, Symptomatic Treatment of Uncomplicated Lower Urinary Tract Infections in the Ambulatory Setting, Randomized Double-Blind Trial. This is BMJ 2017, back in November. So in this study, what the researchers did was they randomized 250 women to either get an NSAID, diclofenac, or norfloxacin twice daily for 3 days. And then the participants were also received a single 3-gram dose of fosfomycin as a quote-unquote rescue antibiotic if the symptoms persisted after they were put in their assigned treatment. Now, symptom resolution, that's what we're looking at here. And at day 3, symptom resolution occurred in 54% of those in the NSAID group and 80% of those in the norfloxacin group, with a median time of 4 days for the NSAIDs and 2 days for the norfloxacin as a median time to symptom relief. Now, there's a couple points of interest, I think, here, is that 54% of people got better with an NSAID. That's something to hang our hat on. Now, don't get me wrong, the antibiotic did better, which I would expect the antibiotic to do better to treat a bacterial infection. That makes sense to me. But 54% of the time, just an NSAID did a pretty darn good job. And this wasn't without complications. If you looked at rates of pyelonephritis, which is kind of a big deal, 6 of those in the NSAID group ended up with pyelonephritis, and none of those in the antibiotic group developed pyelonephritis. Now, there is a push or a rage or a rush, if you will, to say, hey, listen, urinary tract infections these days, maybe we don't need to give them an antibiotic. Maybe we can give them a pocket prescription. And they, just like, you know, with upper respiratory tract infections or whatever, we can give them a pocket prescription and then they fill it in a day or two. Here's the dilemma. Here's the problem is that I personally have never had a urinary tract infection. And those that come in that have urinary tract infections, or they come in the office with a urinary tract infection, they seem miserable. They seem not only miserable, but so uncomfortable, they would rather cut off their leg or a limb than continue with this urinary tract infection. And so I think that to withhold antibiotics at this point, even though I agree, the evidence in more than one study now points to that maybe we could get away with not giving everyone an antibiotic, is just cruel and unusual punishment and torture. Now, this is when I think it gets interesting, or where at least the conversation needs to be had. And if you go back and listen to the piece I did on antibiotics here in Questioning Medicine, you will note the big myth about antibiotics is that we currently treat for 3 days. But 3 days, just about like everything with antibiotics, is a mythical, made-up number. I mean, we used to treat for 14 days, and then 10 days, and then 7 days, and then sometimes 5 days, and now 3 days, and then there's a push now for 0 days. I think that it's not necessarily 0 days is the best answer, but likely 3 days isn't the best answer either. Likely at 2 days or 1.5 days, when your symptoms resolve, you can stop the antibiotics. And I know that people are so going to argue that, hey, listen, Andrew, the reason that we shouldn't give antibiotics is because we're breeding resistance. Well, here's a newsflash. It's not the 1 day of antibiotics that breeds resistance. again, go back to the myth on antibiotics, and you'll see the evidence clearly shows it's the prolonged duration of antibiotics. It's antibiotics for days and days and days and days that you build up a resistance. And so while I think that over the next few years, and maybe even longer than that, probably forever, there's going to probably be this push of, hey, we don't really need to give antibiotics for a urinary tract infection. I mean, the evidence clearly shows that a majority, over 50% of the women, will get better just with an NSAID. Here's the problem. I've never had a urinary tract infection, and they look so uncomfortable. So I personally am going to always continue to give antibiotics. I just will tell them, as I do with most antibiotics, once you feel better, you can probably stop the antibiotic. There's no need to continue it for the full 3 days of treatment. Unless, of course, you're still having symptoms after 3 days. And if that's the case, then you should probably come back in and see me. Now, on to maybe the most exciting article, or at least the most interesting article, I think, of this questioning medicine. And that is, of course, having to do with smoking. Of course, I'm referring to a paper in JAMA Internal Medicine titled Lung Cancer Mortality Associated with Smoking and Smoking Cessation Among People Living with HIV in the United States. This was back in September of 2017. Now, they get a little complicated in this, and I don't want to go into all the details here, but the researchers used old published data, and then they make up this model. And the model was looking at, if you have HIV and you smoke, what is your risk for mortality? What is the risk that you die of smoking as compared to if you just die from HIV? And I think HIV, although it used to be such this big scary thing, it kind of used to be like depression from what I hear. We didn't talk about it, but now it's out there. HIV is a chronic disease. You can live with it forever. And this study demonstrates that maybe better than anything. If you just use the numbers from this study, and if the estimates are correct, then if you're looking at someone who gets HIV or an HIV positive man who is at age 40 and he adheres to the retroviral therapy but continues to smoke about one pack daily or per day, then he has a risk of dying from lung cancer at age 80 that is 10 times his risk for dying from AIDS-related causes. I mean, when you think about that, when you go from 23% to 2.3%, the same HIV man, but one smokes, one doesn't, that is crazy numbers. And I think it just goes to show that all the medications that we have, all of them, nothing can beat smoking. If you have a patient that smokes and you talk about anything else during any visit ever, you're missing the boat. Because a cumulative effect of HIV medication, any statins, you could argue maybe blood pressure long-term if it's extreme hypertension. However, everything else, smoking. Smoking is the number one thing, the number one cost of the healthcare system, the number one association with morbidity and mortality. I mean, when we look at some of the studies that are around different drugs and their cause and effect and their hazard ratios, I mean, we're looking at numbers that are 1.2, 1.3. 3.2 for a hazard ratio. I mean, really, these are massive numbers that, you know, are going to, for sure, this is definitely it. This is definitely causing the patient to be sicker, or this definitely causes the patient to feel better. When you look at the original studies, and it's, you know, observational, but when you look at some of the original hazard ratios for smoking, 10, 11, 12, I mean, the huge numbers that we don't see anymore. Now, I think when we get an HIV patient, a lot of times we all kind of get fixated on the CD4 counts and the viral load and what are the results of the tests and when are we going to test again and what are they getting sick and where do we... But the real thing that needs to be focused on, the real thing that we need to all zone in on, not just for HIV patients, but particularly for HIV patients, is smoking. Smoking cessation, how do we get them off nicotine? And finally, one last piece before I sign this one off. And I'm going to do a short or maybe a little bit a longer piece here in the near future on Entresto, the new heart failure medication that has kind of taken the heart failure treatment by storm. It's interesting. It's based on one large trial that did show benefit, but there was some certainly flaws in that. And it's, again, it's only one trial where they had a lead-in. Anyways, I'm going to cover it all in a future podcast in the very, very near future. That's Sacubitril Valsartan for those of you that don't like to use brand names, but in the future. However, heart failure, it is real. It is in our face. I mean, we're talking almost 6 million patients per year that have heart failure. It behooves you to know something about it. So let's go into my next favorite article, and that is, of course, a paper in the Journal of American College of Cardiology, Heart Failure. This is Discordant Perceptions of Prognosis and Treatment Options Between Physicians and Patients with Advanced Heart Failure. Now, for anyone who takes care of any patients with heart failure, whether it's in the clinic or whether it's in the hospital, you know that it's difficult to tell patients, you know, exactly what's going to happen. What exactly is their prognosis? And this isn't only for heart failure. I think we see this maybe with every type of cancer, disease, or whatever, is people want to know, well, how many years do I have left? How many months do I have left? And I don't know. I mean, we notoriously, the studies show over and over and over again, we as providers, we as physicians are notorious for being awful at giving people long-term prognosis. So that's a really hard thing to do. Now, this study looked at exactly that. What were the perceptions of the provider? What were the perceptions of the patients as far as heart failure? Because I think that we think in our minds, they know that an ejection fraction of 15% in their heart must be bad. And so they know they don't have much time left. While the patient might be saying 15% sounds like a long ways from zero, so I must be good. This looked at 161 patients, average age 59 with advanced heart failure and had a previous hospitalization within the last year. And when you ask the physicians at 1 year, and then you ask the patients at 1 year, what is the risk of death, a transplant, or a ventricular assist device? What would be the risk of this? 69% of the physicians deemed the patients to be at high risk, while only 14% of the patients deemed themselves to be at high risk. The good news for everyone is that neither the physician nor the patient was accurate. Now, the risk estimates differed vastly between what the physician thought and what the patient thought. 42% of the patients deemed to be high risk by their physician estimated their own survival would exceed 5 years. And when asking the patients themselves, only 21% of those that were deemed high risk by the provider thought that their survival would be less than 1 year. And maybe the thing I think points to the most of physicians and providers are just so bad at really saying what your prognosis is. 60% of the patients deemed to be at high risk by the physician were event-free at follow-up in 13 months. And 68% of those that were deemed to be low risk by the physician were event-free at 13 months. So basically 60 to 65%, whether you were high risk or low risk, you were event-free at 13 months. So it all goes, what do we really know anyhow? Not only do patients not read the textbooks, well, they didn't go to medical school, so literally they don't read the textbooks. But even when we should be and we do read the textbooks, who really knows? I mean, who really knows? You can be in heart failure and high risk for death and still be event-free at 13 months. You can completely tear your hamstring and still go running for 30, 40, 50 minutes. You can have a needle stabbed in your eye and still see. There are odd stories out there everywhere, so who are we to say what is real and what is not real? That's what keeps medicine interesting, and that's what keeps me questioning medicine. Now I'm going to end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.